Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane and Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, it's the Autumn Statement Digest. As promised last week, we'll be running the rule over the Chancellor's tax and spending review. Is the government really lowering our taxes? No change to inheritance tax, as had been mooted ahead of time. But National Insurance gets cut, the 1,000th change in 2 weeks. Okay, maybe like the fifth in 2 years, but still is a lot. Also there, the expensive triple lock can gets kicked further down the road as the government decides to keep it intact for now. Not the reform that some had been hoping for with ISAs, but could we soon have a pension pot for life? And finally, the OBR's view. Is Britain on the way back up, or is the struggle far from over? Don't forget, stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, the Chancellor delivered his autumn statement. For once, those who are not financial journalists and kept calling it the budget could have been forgiven, because it certainly felt like one. With speculation aplenty and the odd rabbit pulled out of the hat, there is plenty for the team to pore over. But before we get into the details, Simon, if you remember last week, a week's a long time, isn't it? But I asked you what you were expecting the tone to be. A traditional conservative, fiscally responsible speech? A desperate pre-election tax giveaway? One for the rich, one for the poorest. Did we see Schoolmaster Hunt or Magician Jeremy? Simon, what did we get?
We saw Schoolmaster Hunt trying to be an entertainer and a crowd pleaser. He ditched his sensible jumper and he came in wearing a jazzy tie and decided to say, hey, look at me, everything's getting better. We're going to have
happy birthday to my wife.
Yeah, happy birthday to my wife. We're going to have fun, which was very different to the message this time last year, which was there is no fun. Fun has been cancelled for the foreseeable future. You will need to earn any fun that you expect to have after that, and you'd better behave. So, yeah. You know, it was much more positive, and he repeatedly talked about his plan for growth and how it was all going to be growth, growth, growth.
Well, we'll decide whether it was. Growth, growth, growth. Funny, we got the fun police still in action, only about up to September, I think. And then the fun came to town, didn't it? But before we dig into the detail, I want to get from each of you, if you would. Welcome, Tanya. Welcome, Helen. Your biggest wins from the statement, the thing you were most happy to see, and your biggest disappointment. Perhaps what should have been in there, what was in there but shouldn't be in there. Tanya, have we got a pensions angle from you?
Well, obviously...
Doesn't have to be.
Obviously, it was good that they kept the triple lock, but actually I would go for the business growth measures, especially the sensible one about the full expensing, because it does seem like helping businesses to invest is, you know, a solid thing to do, especially when they're whacking up the corporation tax as much as they are.
And your biggest disappointment?
I think it's the fact that public services look like they're going to be in for another squeeze. They've spent all the headroom that they apparently had on the national insurance cut. But public services need more money because of the, you know, the extra costs from inflation. And they seem to have just hand-waved that.
Helen, from you, your biggest win, your biggest disappointment?
Yeah, so mine actually are both on ISAs. So we had some good news and some bad news. The good news is that people will, from April next year, be able to put money into multiple types of the same ISA in the same year. So you could save into two cash ISAs in the same year, you could save into two stocks and shares ISAs or more in the same year, which would be good because it will help people to switch around to get better rates, and in the case of stocks and shares, to switch to a different provider and sort of get a better deal. So that would be quite positive. I think the bad news on ISAs was that we didn't see any uprating to the allowances in terms of inflation. So still only £20,000 a year you can save into an ISA tax-free. Some people were saying that should have been uprated with inflation. Also, there were no changes to the lifetime ISA. So some people were saying that the maximum allowance that you could put into that a year, it's currently £4,000, could change. That hasn't changed. And there also weren't any changes in the sort of deal that it offers to first-time buyers. So there was talk of raising the maximum property allowance that you can buy with a lifetime ISA above £425,000 to go up with in line with how much property prices have risen since the accounts were started. That didn't happen. And also there was talk of scrapping the withdrawal charge on the lifetime ISA. So currently you take your money out, you pay a 25% charge. There were was kind of chat that to help people sort of struggling maybe with the cost of living, they could scrap that charge. So if people's plans change and they need to get their money, they could do it without a penalty, but that also didn't happen.
It did not. We'll dig into those in more detail later on. For me, definitely the LISA was a big disappointment. Also, the stealth tax was a big disappointment. I'm going to think about what my positive was. So perhaps the self-employed were considered in this statement. Simon, from you?
Well, Helen stole my win there with ISAs. But listeners, as I was under strict instructions not to go into too much detail anyway, because apparently Georgie wants to ask us some questions on this podcast where we will talk about more details, I will just say ISAs. Look, I've been banging the drum about this need to be able to open more than one ISA in the same tax year for years and years and years. So it is nice to actually see a positive change there. My disappointment, the continuing stealth tax freeze on income tax thresholds and the abject failure to fix the mess our tax system is in with marginal tax rate traps that with every year that we do more and more of this fiscal drag get worse and worse because they pull people at a relatively lower level of income into that trap.
Yeah. Simon, I don't want the listener to think that we just sort of ad hoc throw this together. This is well planned, well structured. Anyway, right. One thing before I do move on to the details, Simon, is just, was there a hint that maybe they were holding back? Perhaps we might get some of these measures a little bit closer to election time, potentially.
What? Why would they do that?
That's a great question. Fair question. I mean
if there's something that needs doing, I'm sure you would do it as soon as possible, wouldn't you?
That's exactly right.
I think they're definitely holding back. I think there's definitely some more in the tank. Yeah, there was a couple of suggestions, actually, that this time round, National Insurance, next time round, maybe income tax. Who knows?
I don't know how much more money's in the tank, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. I might ask you this at the end of the podcast. But first, let's go to the rabbit out the hat. The Chancellor always said he wasn't one of those sorts of George Osborne style chancellors. No, he's more sensible, schoolmaster-ish. But no, we got it. The National Insurance would be cut not by 1p, but by 2. What a flourish it was in the speech. And for once, as I said, the self-employed were not ignored. Great. So it could save you £754 as a higher rate salaried taxpayer, £450 for the basic rate taxpayer, average earner, that is. So taxes are going down. Woohoo! Yeah, not quite. Not quite. Simon, you spoke about stealth taxes there. Not so stealthy anymore. Tell us about that. The National Insurance cut. Did we foresee this?
Well, what happened was there was an awful lot of kite flying that happened before this autumn statement. Unusually so. In fact, actually going back again to this time last year, there was an awful lot of kite flying before the last one that Jeremy Hunt delivered, but that was more kite flying of what he might take away from us, what taxes he might put up. Whereas this time round, you know, a week ago, it was a tax cutting bonanza. But there was expectations that maybe he might cut income tax. And then all of a sudden, start this week, it swung around. It's going to be National Insurance. He's cutting a penny off National Insurance. And he didn't. He cut 2p off National Insurance. So he's taken 2 percentage points off the rate of National Insurance. National Insurance, the main rate of National Insurance is 12%. And it's now going to be cut to 10%. National Insurance is in itself a sneaky tax because National Insurance is effectively an income tax. You pay National Insurance at that rate pretty much between the same level at which you start paying basic rate tax and the level at which you start paying higher rate 40% tax, which is £50,270. At which point, any money earned above that is levied, National Insurance is levied at 2% instead. So what this effectively means is that when everybody says we've got a 20% tax rate and we've got a 40% tax rate on income, that's not actually true. What we have is a 32% tax rate and a 42% tax rate. And so it's now going to be 30 and still 42 because that 2% is remaining at the higher level. And it is equivalent to an income tax cut. The big difference between national insurance and income tax is that those of state pension age and above do not pay national insurance. So even if they're still working, they don't pay NI. That's due to this link between NI and the state pension. Now, this means that pensioners won't get the cut, but pensioners, as we're going to talk about in a bit, did get their state pension uprated by 8.5%. So that's not too bad there. And there has been criticism about the amount of money that's gone towards pensioners and not gone to people of working age. So you can see the logic behind this national insurance cut. The problem is, as we said, they haven't moved up the income tax thresholds in line with inflation. I mean, at the most basic level, you should move them up with inflation. And that means that if you get an inflation matching pay rise, then your standard of earning just stays the same. But as it stands, by not raising those tax thresholds with inflation and freezing them instead, you get an inflation matching pay rise. And then if you're a 20% taxpayer, tax nicks 20% of that, because otherwise what would happen is the point at which you start paying basic rate tax would move up with inflation. So it drags a bit out at the bottom. And if you're a higher rate taxpayer, well, then tax is going to nick 40% of it. And the worst effect of this is for people who are on the cusp of higher rate tax. And so if you take the example where somebody earns £50,000 a year, now this national insurance cut is going to save them £750. But by not raising the threshold, if they've got themselves a 5% pay increase, for example, of £2,500, they're going to pay £1,000 in tax at 40% instead of 500 due to the not raising of that threshold. So you've basically, here's £750, I'll have 500 quid back. You're still £250 up. If you get a bumper 10% pay rise, then they would pay £2,000 in tax at 40% rather than £1,000. Here's £750, I'll have 1,000 back there. If you had an inflation matching pay rise, you roughly lose out about £600 in tax and you gain about £750 in national insurance. So that's what's going on there. But it wouldn't be so bad if it was only 1 year, but it's not only 1 year. It's been frozen since 2021 and the plan is to freeze it until 2028. And the Office of Budget Responsibility actually laid out quite how many people are going to be dragged into higher rate tax by this and quite how much this is going to pull in. And it is a sizable number. And the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which is a think tank, which looks at tax and things like that, and is usually, you know, it's pretty measured, it's non-partisan, all that kind of stuff, has called this a colossal stealth tax. And that is what it is.
Tanya, a colossal stealth tax. Are we just looking a gift horse in the mouth? Look, the Chancellor's doing what he can to reduce taxes and, you know, national insurance is where it's at the minute. And
well, yeah, I mean, he's given us a colossal tax increase and then he's refunding us a bit of it to make things seem less bad, I suppose, and bringing it in at the beginning of January as well. So we can look forward to it all over Christmas and then in the new year.
I'm a freelancer, so I get it from April.
Oh, OK. Sorry about
still there.
That.
Yeah, well,
okay,
you know,
well,
what can you do?
Not you, but everyone
yeah, everyone else.
Everyone else can look forward to a January gift. Overall, it's not looking a pretty picture. They might do something on income tax and even in inheritance tax in the spring budget. It is looking more likely, though, that they're keeping their options open for an election, because if they have at least done this, then if they need to go early next year or decide to for some reason, then they've at least got something to talk about, I guess, on the doorstep. We'll see.
We're not a political podcast, but it is, we can't ignore the fact that some of these measures may never see the light of day. But one thing that was heavily kite flown, if you can say that, Tanya, you mentioned their inheritance tax just very briefly. Were you surprised it wasn't in there? Would you like to see some sort of reform in inheritance tax?
Well, I wasn't surprised because they talked about it for weeks and weeks, and I was actually fairly sure they were going to have to do something on it, to the point where I'd written the story giving all the options and all the different ways, you know, what they would save at different levels. But then they seemed to get cold feet over the weekend and started briefing against the briefings they'd previously given last weekend saying it had all been shelved. And yes, we're not political, but basically the reason seemed to have been political. Government sources literally said directly to the Sunday papers, we're worried that Labour will weaponise it because it's a tax cut for the rich. 4% of estates pay it, and they're obviously the richer ones.
But there is an important point on that whole making tax and the way that decisions get politicised, especially decisions to potentially unpick bad bits of the tax code. Inheritance tax, most people don't pay it, but the number of estates that are paying it is rising rapidly. And the most people don't pay it statistics look very different if you adjust for only certain parts of the country that deliver most of the tax take. And then you will find that the number of families who do incur inheritance tax as a percentage increases really quite dramatically, because a lot of this is down to high house prices. And, you know, you can say, as we talked about last week, is that's unearned wealth. People say, well, I paid my mortgage, you know, I worked hard, I've earned this, why should I be taxed twice? And it's like, well, house price inflation, you know, that's not earned wealth. That is unearned wealth. But ultimately, those people have children who can't afford to live in the towns that they grew up in. And to be honest, a lot of them, if you said to them, would you swap the house price inflation for the scenario where your children and your grandchildren can afford to buy a home in the town they grew up in? They'd probably go, yeah, fine. House price inflation doesn't really benefit me, because it only benefits me if I sell up and either move somewhere completely different and then I don't live anywhere near my friends and family, or if I die and then my family get the money. But dying is not usually considered a win.
No.
You know, but it means that because of this concern about being seen to be pandering to the rich, even though actually, if you look at the figures, Office of Tax Simplification, we'll go over old ground again, the really, really rich pay less in inheritance tax than the sort of pretty rich, but, you know, not the top, top scale. But also it means that they're not unpicking these marginal tax traps I referred to. For example, the removal of child benefit of £50,000 to £60,000 that was introduced by George Osborne. That £50,000 hasn't budged. The number of people that are being pulled into that, you know, that's now pulling people who would have been the equivalent of like £35,000 earners at the time into that trap. I haven't done the maths on that, so, you know, feel free to dispute the actual number, but you get the principle. Again, the removal of the personal allowance, this above £100,000, very difficult to feel any kind of sympathy for people who are earning more than £100,000, but they're paying a marginal tax rate of 60%. Those people having child benefit removed, if they've got one child, the marginal tax rate they pay, you know, on the next pound earned, 51%. If they've got two children, 59%. People are paying 60% tax between 100 and 125,140. That means that our income tax rates go 20%, 40%, 60%, 45%. It's totally nuts. It's so indefensible that we have repeatedly asked every single chancellor of at least the last decade to give us a quote to explain why they haven't fixed this. We haven't had a single response yet, a single answer. Not one of them will give an explanation to everybody out there about why they won't fix these things. And that illustrates how indefensible they are. But they won't change them, because it will be seen as helping the more well-off.
Well, they're too busy. That's why they're not doing it, because they're too busy to even get back to you. Tanya?
On inheritance tax, to Simon's point about the fiddly little things that they add to it, one of the things about inheritance tax is there's a special rate for people who own a home and have children, and you actually get a much higher threshold, big change in the threshold from 325,000 to 500,000. If that is the case. And one of the things that would have been really good and would have been a sort of tidying up exercise on a rather silly bit of the inheritance tax system would be to just create a £500,000 threshold for everybody. It wouldn't have been as eye-catching, though, as, say, slashing the rate. And back to what we were saying about, OK, this is a pre-election political or autumn statement, that kind of sensible measure would probably have been rejected as not exciting enough to announce in this particular period.
I agree with you about the 500,000 limit. This system seems quite unfair. Like, I'm not married, so I don't see why you should have a situation. I don't have kids where you should, part of it should be contingent on whether you have children or grandchildren or whatever to pass on some of your wealth. But Helen, this also goes to the fairness or the point of tax. You know, we're talking about the stealth tax here. It's going to, I think, by 2029, draw 4 million extra people into paying tax, 3 million into the higher rate tax, inheritance tax. If you're freezing the threshold, it's putting more and more people. These were supposed to be for the very wealthiest in society. I think you're going to be having something like a fifth of senior nurses who are going to be drawn into the higher rate tax band, et cetera, et cetera. This is not fair. Like, if people don't understand the tax and it's sort of lost its meaning, they're going to be less likely to want to agree with it and pay it.
Yeah, you're completely right. It is, you know, especially with, if you look at inflation over the past few years, like people who are earning these amounts that put them into the higher tax band, they don't feel richer. You know, even people who've had a pay rise, for a lot of people, pay rises are going straight into things like higher mortgage rates, you know, just the general higher kind of cost of living. And you're right, I think there are a lot of people who will see this kind of tax, stealth tax rise as a really kind of hard thing for them. And it doesn't seem fair at all. You're right, you know, things are difficult at the moment. And, you know, okay, they've had this announcement of the lower national insurance, which on the face of it seems like a bit of a boon, but it doesn't take much kind of digging under the surface for people to see that they're not actually going to be better off.
Times have they changed national insurance though? I can't keep up, honestly. It is about five times, isn't it, in the past two and a bit years, is it? Anyway, look, we're going to go to pensions now. Tanya, I turn to you. Two things particularly came to my mind, but I'm sure you digged into this and more and found a lot more than I did. But the triple lock you mentioned there, staying put for now, and a pot for life being consulted on. We'll dig into that one in more detail, but firstly, the triple lock. How expensive is it? I said it was an expensive can to kick down the road because it does feel like someone's going to have to deal with this. Can it go on forever?
Well, we're going to keep paying into it, so we're going to keep expecting to get something out of it. In terms of how much it costs, the spending on the state pension is rolled into all sorts of other things to do with pension credit for the poorest, housing benefit and winter fuel allowance. And for the current tax year, the OBR is putting it all of that, about 142 billion for this year, 153 billion for the year after. So that is obviously an awful lot of money. In terms of what people are going to get on the triple lock, it's probably worth just saying what the weekly amount is going to go up to, £221.20 if you're on the full headline rate for people who've reached state pension age since 2016. The old system, which was a two-tier system, the old basic rate, you're going to get £169.50 a week. But a lot of people have second state pension on top of that, so it will be higher. In terms of them announcing this, I felt, and I wrote beforehand, that if they were going to do the full 8.5%, then they were going to stand up and announce it in the autumn statement. If they were going to fudge it and give us 7.8% because they were going to do something a bit strange and a bit sneaky with whether they were going to include bonuses in the wages figure, then they would put out some kind of statement, maybe not even on the day, but later to get their excuses in, but a bit more quietly. But the truth is you can't do anything quietly with a state pension or a triple lock. People really, really care about it. So there's no hiding place.
Especially your readers. I keep hammering this home, not a political podcast, but Simon, is there a part that makes you think, had the government got perhaps a better poll reading, they might have looked at this if they were there guaranteed, you know, no election coming? Actually, they might have assessed whether this is a sustainable policy. 10.1% increase this year, 8.5% increase next year.
That is true. But the crucial thing about promises is that you need to stick to them. And they've already broken their promise once on the triple lock.
Precisely.
So, what you do if you do that is you don't then use it as an excuse to just keep breaking your promise. Well, you end it for good, yeah. But it was part of their manifesto. My personal view is that I would like to see the main political parties stand in the next election with a better policy than the triple lock. that is more clearly outlined. Because I think one of the problems with the triple lock is that it has raised the state pension substantially, which is good news for people who are state pensioners. It's also good news for all of us lot who aren't, because when it, you know, the magic of compounding means that it should be higher when we hopefully get it. And I know there's a lot of like, well, it's not going to be around when I retire kind of stuff, but you know, it should be, hopefully. We'll have been really sold down the river if it isn't. But I do think that one of the issues with the triple lock, as I said, is it's very clearly sort of ill-defined. It's like, well, why are those numbers used? You know, what's the point? Do we want it to go up by wages? Do we want it to go up by inflation? Or do we, you know, just want to give a baseline number? The baseline number is not a bad idea. So I think a better plan is a double lock with a clearly outlined reason behind it, which is that we think it's a good thing if pensioners not only have their income match inflation, but they get a little bit better off each year. We want our pensioners to get a little bit better off each year. So it's going to be inflation plus 1% or the inflation target plus 1%. So if inflation is higher, government and Bank of England haven't managed to get inflation to the inflation target, then they get inflation plus 1%, a little bit richer. And if it is just they manage to get to the target, if it's lower than the target, then it's the inflation target plus 1%. That's my idea. It's not the only idea, but it is an idea. And at least you can clearly articulate the idea behind it and why you're doing it, which I think with the triple lock, it's got a bit muddied and people can't really do that.
It is an idea, Simon. That is true. Tanya, is it a good idea? What would you like to see?
I don't really see a problem with sticking with the triple lock, to be absolutely honest with you. I know that Simon says that plan would be more straightforward, and perhaps it would be. But triple lock, it's a good marketing tool in a way. People, you know, love the triple lock. And I'm sure part of the reason is that something that is triple locked, they might not know what all the elements are, but it sounds like it's really super guaranteed because it's triple guaranteed. And so they like it. We'll have to see what they come up with in the manifestos. I was thinking this morning, well, at least the triple lock bun fight is over for another year. And I thought, oh, no, it's not, is it? Because yeah, we've got this election coming and everyone will be speculating about the manifestos even before we get them. And unless they jump together and both the main parties say we're going to do something, we're going to go to a double lock, then I think that they're going to try and outbid each other. Because older voters do vote, and that is almost the beginning and end of it, really. Yeah, so we'll have to see. But if you ask me what I think will happen, they'll all commit to the triple lock again, and then we'll start having, you know, another fight about it every single year.
Brilliant. Excellent. Can't wait. So, Tanya, the other big thing that I sort of noted there of pensions, the pot for life. I mean, on the face of it, great. We're doing loads of jobs. What is it? The average is 11 or something, which means loads of pension pots, loads of fees to pay. But there's a few sort of unhappy dissenting voices on this one. I think Sir Steve Webb is one of those. What is a pot for life? Good idea? Bad idea?
The idea is that at first you would get a right when you started a new job to ask your employer to pay into an existing pot instead of putting you into their scheme that they've organised on all their staff's behalf. And then it would move to a system where really everybody would just have one pot and all employers would have to pay into your pot. If you didn't make a choice, there would probably be some defaulting into some existing employer scheme. But the idea is that we'd all take ownership of our one pot, take it through life, keep paying into it, and so on. And it sounds on the face of it to be a great idea in terms of convenience and keeping all your money in one place rather than building up lots of pots. But there are potentially considerable downsides to it, which people have been pointing out. There is a great benefit to having employers really have a duty to come up with a good pension scheme. There are lots of rules and regulations and duties placed on them to actually come up with something good, and also to keep checking that it's valuable for money and keep the costs down. And they're really responsible for all that on our behalf. And the idea of each individual person being able to sort of bring to bear that amount of knowledge on whether a pension pot scheme that they choose, say in their 20s, is good in terms of costs, what kind of investment strategy it is. Most people go into their default pension scheme because they don't understand the investment fund choice that they get anyway. And so the idea that they'd be equipped to actually choose a decent pension pot for life is dubious, to say the least. And obviously, you know, even if employers had to have a backup scheme to default people into, the chances are they take a lot less interest in it as well. So it might work for some people who are very engaged and know a lot about investment, but those people, frankly, are pretty good at looking after their retirement savings already. And the fear really is that poorer people who have got less knowledge about pensions and about investments, and also about how to compare costs. We all know how difficult it is to compare costs in everything. And investment costs are pretty fiddly to get your head around. It seems unlikely that we'd all as individuals be good at that. So we might end up with worse pensions in the longer run. And I also think it is worth pointing out that the kind of pension you need in your 20s is not the kind of pension that will be beneficial to you when you're in your 50s, approaching and starting to think about retirement. And a lot of people just won't move. So far, all I've been talking about is the pros and cons for individuals. But I think it's worth having a nod to the absolutely seismic change it would be for the pension industry. Some companies would, I'm sure, benefit from it, some bits of the pension industry, and others not so much. But one thing that really there is consensus on is that employers will not want to be sending contributions here, there and everywhere for each employer, rather than just sending them all to one place as they do at the moment. So there'd have to be some kind of clearinghouse system set up. People have said, well, who's going to pay for that? I've not heard an answer to that one yet. But if it ends up being a premium on everybody's pension costs because we've all got to pay for a clearinghouse that we didn't have before, then that's another downside. That's pot
in
pot
some
line.
Yes, no, yes, no. Could it work? Well,
yes, it could work, but I think they've announced a consultation, Georgie. And that means that they're not sure, and they want to have a big debate about it and argue it all out, probably for quite a long time. And also, I did a search this morning to see if Labour has said anything yet. They might have, but I couldn't find anything that they said on it. If they did win the next election, what they thought of this idea would be the difference between it just being kicked straight out again or it going into a long consultation period. Anyone who's followed pension dashboards over the last decade will know that they take a long, long time to come up with something like this. And if it involves setting up a clearinghouse from scratch, well, to me, that sounds more complicated than a pensions dashboard. So before everyone gets really excited about having a pension pot for life, I think just bear in mind that it could be a long way off, if ever, before they see it.
Right. Fair. I do want to just ask you a word about benefits. So obviously, we've got the triple lock going up, as was promised. Also, benefits, they went up by the higher September inflation figure, but not all sweetness and light for those who need extra help. What else was announced there, Tanya?
Well, benefits are going to go up by 6.7%, which will be a relief to people who rely on them, because there was some talk beforehand about using the lower inflation figure. I think it was 4.6 in the following month. So that is a good thing, especially for pensioners on pension credit, because there's a lot of hardship among elderly people. One of the things that I would say about the new rules on benefits, that they really do sound quite punitive for some people, especially people who might be ill and fall foul of the benefits system. It was actually announced in the run-up to the budget that there's some issues if you don't engage with the benefits system, that you might have your free NHS prescriptions taken away. I do find this really a bit mad and counterproductive, because I think the people who are most likely to be not engaging with the benefits process are probably going to be sick and unwell, might have mental health issues. And then to not have access to medicine seems to be really counterproductive. we'll have to see how it pans out, because they've been talking about it only if people don't engage with the benefit system for a long time and make no effort to get to work. But the idea of cutting people off from benefits completely does seem unnecessarily punitive. Look, I deal with the DWP a lot because of things like state pension top-ups and all things state pension related. And I hear again and again from people who find it really hard to get through to the right person. When something bad's happened, they find it really difficult to get it put right. Now, I don't deal so much with people on the benefits side, but I would be really worried that somebody would get trapped in that. And if the upshot is not that you have to wait a bit longer for your state pension top-up to be processed, but you literally lose all your income, then that does strike me as really, really harsh. And we had a taste of it when they got into real trouble about a year and a half ago with not processing new state pension claims. We really saw a lot of people fall through the gap because all their benefits, like housing benefit and so on, would stop at their 66th birthday, but then their new state pension claims weren't kicking in. And even in the space of a month or so, people were literally going hungry and getting really desperate. We had absolutely desperate messages from people. So I like to think we're a bit of a kinder country than that. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But there are some worrying statistics about suicides among people who really struggle to get their benefits sorted out properly.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Ben Laidler of eToro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Hello, Ben. How's the past week been?
Well, it's been a positive week for global stocks, and it's been a very busy week in the UK. We've had the government's autumn budget statement. That included a 2% cut to national insurance rates, which is going to put some money back into consumers' pockets. Just as the key Christmas spending season kicks off with Black Friday and the Cyber Monday sales. That's the good cheer, but partly offset by the electricity regulator announcing a small increase in our winter heating bills, which we're going to start paying from January.
And what do we have to look forward to on the markets next week? Is it a big week? It's been quieter this week because of Thanksgiving, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's a quieter one, but you know, it is the last week of November. We're on track, at least in global markets, for the strongest November in three years, if I haven't just jinxed it. And this Santa rally has really come early this year. Now, the FTSE 100 in the UK has definitely lagged that. But as we look ahead to December, this is typically the best month of the year as investors reallocate in anticipation of the year ahead. So there's definitely still some hope. If you look back at the last 40 years for the FTSE 100, in average, it's up 2.3% in December. That's the best month of the year and typically makes up about a third of the total annual gain in just 1 month. So I guess we'll see. We're also getting the quarterly rebalance of the FTSE 100. So it looks like Hargreaves Lansdown's going to be out and Interactive Capital's going to be in.
Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Now, Helen, at the start, you spoke about ISAs. Before the autumn statement, there was lots about ISA simplification and reform. We got a bit more about saving into the same ISA, a bit about fractional shares, nothing, as you said, about the LISA, nothing to my mind that made it look that much more simple. Also, we got an extension of the mortgage guarantee scheme, some plan to divide houses into two flats, but what else for property before that? Let's just go over the ISA reform.
The first thing to say is I definitely don't think it's made saving into an ISA more simple. So Jeremy Hunt actually didn't mention this ISA change in his speech. Clearly, he doesn't think ISA reform is exciting enough to merit a mention in the speech itself, but we do. Also, we actually had to find it out from a tweet on the Treasury account, and it's this lovely graphic that says, simplifying ISAs, making it easier to save. I wouldn't say it has made it simpler. I'd say it has given people more choice and more flexibility, but I don't think it has made the rules around saving into ISA easier to understand. A lot of people still don't really understand the point of an ISA, or certainly don't understand it beyond saving into a cash ISA. So I don't think it's really changed that. What it has changed is it's made it easier for people to shop around and get the best rate. And it means that they don't have to wait until the next tax year to do that. So if you had, if you'd opened one cash ISA and later in the year you saw another one with a better rate, this is from April 2024, you'd be able to switch to that new account with no penalty. At the moment, if you did that, you would have your interest taken away and the second account would be shut down. So that's a really good change. And I think, you know, it's difficult for a lot of people to save at the minute. And I do think it's a good move for the government to make that easier. You know, people are trying hard to still save and they're being rewarded for it in this way, which I do think is good. It's also good for people who save into stocks and shares ISAs, because, you know, we've seen loads of innovation in this space in the last few years, loads of new providers springing up, offering different ways of kind of saving into a stocks and shares ISA, different kind of fee levels. And it means that people be able to kind of shop around and find the best deal for them. So I do think that's a piece of good news.
Simon, from the investor's point of view.
I think that the decision to let people invest new money into more than one type of ISA in the same year is a very good decision. The reason why I've been banging the drum on this for ages is because I think that with a £20,000 allowance, most people cannot use that entire £20,000 allowance in a year. I would like to start see that being uprated by inflation, because I think that's just what you should do. But it means that, for example, you can choose to fix your savings and you can choose to have some easy access savings as well. And that's a good way of splitting your money, because you might have some money that you can lock away for a year and some money that you need to access quickly. And from an investment point of view, there are lots and lots of different types of investment account now. And the ISA system has been stuck somewhere in the early 2000s. And now you might have one account that's better for investing in funds and trusts. You might have a different platform that's better for buying shares if you want to be picking shares. But more importantly, you might have another platform which will do the work for you. It will manage the money for you. So you might choose to say, for example, I'm going to put some of my money into somewhere where I pick my own funds and investment trusts, maybe some of it even into one where I pick some shares and I just have a little shares portfolio. But then I'm also going to put a chunk of my money into somewhere where somebody does the work for me. And usually this isn't an actual person picking the investments for you directly. That's expensive, usually only for the very wealthy. But it's a system. It's a computer system that does it for you. And what you won't get there is necessarily the best returns every single year. But what you will probably get is less volatility and your money managed better, because ultimately it's built professionally and it's not quite as susceptible to the same bad decisions that individual investors make with their own money. Or it might be that actually there's a place where you can just invest your money in a passive fund for the cheapest possible cost. And you go, right, that's going to be the core of my investment portfolio. That's going into the cheap global tracker fund where I'm just going to back the market. I'm not going to try to be, you know, Mr. Smarty Pants, try and beat it, and then run the risk of falling behind when actually I'm trying to get ahead. And then I'm going to use a smaller chunk of my money to do that. And I also think it should help bring down costs, because it increases competition. We live in a consumer economy that is based on the idea of competition, companies competing with each other. And the problem with only being able to put new money into one ISA each year is that you've got your standard account, your Hargreaves account, your Interactive Invest account, your AJ Bell one. You've had it for years. You always put a bit of money into it. But then you go, well, I try out that newcomer, but I don't want to do that because I've got my money in there. And it's just too complicated. And I could move a bit of my old ISA allowance and sort of do it that way. You know, people in the finance industry love telling you this. They're like, oh, well, you could just transfer an old ISA allowance and do it like that. It's like most people can't even get their head around ISAs, as Helen just said. It's like they're not going to be doing this crazy complicated stuff. You need to make it easy for people, and this does make it easier for people. The one thing I would like to see is a much, much greater use of flexible ISAs and people offering flexible ISAs where you can take money out, and as long as you pay it back in within the same tax year, it doesn't count as part of that year's allowance. And that's really important for savings, particularly with savings rates having gone up and so many more people being caught by the by tax due to going through the personal savings allowance. If you can use an ISA now instead, then you see a real benefit from that.
All right, then. Helen, just one thing. We did sort of speculate about changes to the savings personal allowance. Nothing there. Also, throw me what happened in property. I mean, LISA seems quite a nice natural progression. No change there?
Yeah, no changes to the LISA, which I think is a shame. It's a shame for first-time buyers who make up quite a large portion of the people who use these accounts, and also for people who are saving for retirement. I think the main change that will affect potentially you know, anyone who saves into a LISA is that they haven't scrapped the withdrawal penalty. So at the moment, if you take your money out and you don't use it to buy your first home or after the age of, I think, 55, basically to take the money out for retirement, there's a 25% penalty, which means that you lose not only the government bonuses paid, you lose a little bit of your own money as well, which I think is, it's one of the big things that puts people off saving into these accounts. And I think, you know, even just bringing it down, you don't necessarily have to scrap it completely, would just make people feel a bit more comfortable saving into those accounts, because it is a really good account. You know, you can save up to £4,000 a year and you get basically a £1,000 government bonus if you save that maximum amount. So it's a really good way to save. But I think these restrictions are putting people off. The other issue, as I think I mentioned before, is they haven't uprated this maximum property price that you can buy with money saved in your LISA. So it's £450,000, which is a lot. You know, this is one of those issues that people might say, you know, this is just people in London, the Southeast. No other first-time buyer is going to be buying a property that expensive. But I do think as the average age of people who are buying a property goes up, you will see people buying more expensive properties, their first property, potentially all over the country. You know, people who, for example, buy their first property when they've had children will need to buy a bigger house. And I think, you know, as buying property gets more difficult, you're going to see more and more of those people who, you know, their first home isn't a one bedroom flat. It might have to be a three bedroom house. And to look at the figures as well. So since the LISA was introduced in 2017, that allowance hasn't been rated at all. If the property price allowance had gone up with inflation, that would be more than £560,000. So I think if you look back at maybe someone who put the money back in 2017, the thing you have to think of is we also had this massive property price rise during the pandemic. No one putting their money in 2017 could have foreseen that, really. You know, everyone knows that property prices go up, but I don't think anyone would have expected, you know, 20% house price rise during the pandemic. And I think that would have just made it fairer. You know, it probably wouldn't actually cost the government that much money. You know, a lot of people don't buy houses that are worth that much, but I think it would just make it fair for everyone.
Simon, a plan about dividing houses sort of pricked up when I heard that. I thought, what was that about?
We were talking about this in the office yesterday. I don't know where this half-baked idea, but this is a recipe for argument and neighbourhood dispute. The idea
and
of it is
stoddy
that,
homes and all sorts.
Yeah. I mean, what we need is a plan to solve the housing crisis. And solving the housing crisis is not delivered just by saying, here's a target, let's meet it. Because actually the targets are one of the problems with the housing crisis. And it means that we do build new homes, but they're not really great. People don't like them that much. They tend to be too small. They're built on too small plots. They don't have much of a garden. They don't have much parking. They're not really that much in demand from people. They'd rather buy existing homes, even though new homes are sold as a premium product. And we need to get around that. We need to encourage communities to want home building near them. We need to make people think, okay, I'm actually pro new houses being built near me, because what's happening here is my town, my village, my city, my community is being taken into account. The infrastructure is going to be put in place. People aren't going to be pushed further and further away from the countryside by just rings of building around it. You build with a hub and spoke, for example. So you build green passageways out. If COVID taught us anything, it's how much people value being able to get out to the countryside, being able to get out to open spaces. So you need to create it so that the open spaces come into the town. There's none of the talk of that. There's none of the talk of building better homes. What we got was a plan that to make it that under permitted development, you could turn a house into two flats as long as you didn't change the look of the outside. this might be okay in cities, right? But even then, the effect of this, all you have to do is look back over the last 50 to 100 years. The effect of dividing houses into flats is that people end up living in smaller and smaller properties, whereas once upon a time, they would have been able to live in a house. Okay, and that's not generally what they want. And they don't get the outside space because only one person gets the outside space and things like that. But this is a charter for absolute anarchy in the suburbs, where developers are going to go buy detached houses, turn them into two flats. I mean, define a flat. Now, a flat doesn't have to be on top, one on top of the other, does it? Because what you could do is you could have two flats that are side by side, aka semi-detached houses. Don't change the front door. Both people still go in the front door, and then one goes left, one goes right. You take the detached house, you turn it into two semis. As a developer, you buy it, you've got deeper pockets than a family who's trying to move up the ladder. And you also know that you can do the work yourself, and then you can make yourself a nice 50% profit or something. You're not going to double your money, but you make yourself a nice profit. You just totally nuts. This is, and whenever you see things like this, okay, applications like this, councils normally fight tooth and nail to stop family homes being converted into flats. They do it for a reason, you know, to protect the housing stock that is in their local area and to protect the character of those local areas, okay? It's not just to be mean to people and create a scenario where we're creating less homes. And local residents complain bitterly about this kind of stuff. So, I mean, if this comes in and developers, as was kind of mooted, would just be able to go, right, there you go, I'll buy that house, going to turn it into flats, can't argue with me. I can't see this one ending well. And I also can't really see it solving the housing crisis. What I can see is it increasing the number of substandard too small homes that people in Britain live in.
Oh, I'm glad you thought the same, because I was just listening to that thinking, what? Anyway, before we draw a line under the autumn statement for now, it wasn't just us running the rule over it, was it? It was the Office for Budget Responsibility, and arguably, one might suggest, their assessment is slightly more important than ours. I don't know, but there you go. The Chancellor called this an autumn statement for growth, but was it? Before we get to the OBR, one area we haven't massively touched on, except Tanya earlier talking about expensing, full expensing, but help for businesses, especially SMEs, no stop to the dividend tax cuts, capital gains tax cuts, corporate tax still going up, and no help for national insurance contributions for employers, it seemed.
No, all of those things. Some rates relief for the hospitality and retail sectors. Not really a game changer for small businesses, but seen as being a little bit of getting there and a little bit of, you know, it's okay. The full expensing thing obviously does apply to them as well. And the full expensing thing is quite important, but I don't necessarily think that it's the kind of budget that's going to have small businesses, particularly the self-employed and sole traders, bouncing around going, this is great for me. I don't think that the very small cut they're getting in national insurance is going to make up for all the pain that they've suffered in the last 3 to 4 years.
Quite. Just finally then, the OBR, what did they say? What economic forecasts are we looking out for? Are they always right? You know, where next in terms of our money from the government?
Well, I mean, as Jeremy Hunt stood up and delivered his plan for growth and repeatedly talked about growth, the OBR, unfortunately, tweeted a graph and said, this is our forecast for growth. We'll be releasing the rest of our report when the autumn statement finishes. The forecast for growth, unfortunately, largely looked lower than they did before. So, to be fair, 2023 has been upgraded from a 0.2% fall in GDP to a 0.6% rise. 2024, unfortunately, downgraded from 1.8% forecasting growth in March to a 0.7% forecasting growth now. 2025 doesn't look as good either. In March, we were growing by 2.5%. Now we're only going to grow by 1.4%. 2026, March, we were going to grow by 2.1%. Now we're only going to grow by 2%. But if you get to 2027, things are looking up. The forecast is better. We were going to grow by 1.9%. We're now going to grow by 2%. And 2028 looks amazing until you realise that actually there was no forecast in March. And that's why the line is so much higher than the one next to it when we were forecast to grow by 1.7%. Now, this illustrates two things. One, potentially the OBR suggests that this isn't quite as growthy as Jeremy Hunt suggested, although there are other OBR charts that illustrate the economy will actually be bigger than thought over the next few years, largely due to post-COVID revisions that have happened that show that actually the economy has been doing better. But also it illustrates why you shouldn't read too much into these forecasts, because March wasn't that long ago, and there's quite a big change in these forecasts, and it's highly likely that these forecasts will change again by next March. So whilst we can look in more detail at inflation, which the OBR says is going to stay higher for longer than previously thought, interest rates, again, higher for longer than previously thought, and things like that, it should be taken with the massive caveat that these forecasts are often very, very wrong and subject to change.
Lovely. Simon, thank you. Helen, Tanya, thank you very much. You can keep up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney and come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
Just a quick one, Simon. What's the point of economic forecasts if they're wrong?
It gives people like us something to talk about.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
And also, it offers up the opportunity for everybody to start tweeting while the Chancellor is still talking. Ah, you're saying growth. This looks down to me. And things like that. Well, they're important, aren't they? You've got to base your decisions on something. And they're the best forecast. Look, actually, to be honest, it's much better that we have the OBR than prior to having the OBR. The OBR is pretty good. The Office for Budget Responsibility is pretty good at running the rule over Chancellor's numbers. And I would certainly like to see the OBR stick around.
Excellent. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.